sequence that you've probably heard of. Appears in several places. It's most famous in the Upanishad Sutta. It's describing how from the depths of suffering a person can emerge, bring the mind to gladness, develop the bliss of meditation, of being secluded from unwholesome states, develop tranquility of body and mind, and develop samadhi or concentration, the deep concentrated meditation. And then based on that samadhi, they have a chance to see and understand things as they really are. That's the insight emerging from samadhi or within samadhi. And when they see things as they really are, then they become disenchanted with a clinging to the ordinary merry-go-round of life. Their passions fade away. They experience the cessation of suffering. And with that cessation of suffering, they know freedom or they know emancipation. So this is a very beautiful ladder that goes step by step by step from the depth of suffering right up to full emancipation. And what I see in myself and in some other Westerners who are serious meditators is people who have practiced for a while spend a lot of time developing their concentration, their sitting meditation practice, and learning how to see things just as they are. That's their mindfulness. And then letting go. Letting go of whatever is impermanent. Especially if afflictions or negativities come along, they practice letting go of their negative states of mind. The thing is that beautiful practice, which is so much to the heart of Vipassana, can sometimes get to be maybe too dry or something, or someone may feel like they're hitting a glass ceiling. They can go so far, but they can't go any further. And it's possible that the reason that they come to a sort of a stalemate in the evolution of their practice is that the foundations are not well in place. And actually, what are the foundation? The foundation is gladness. The foundation is knowing how to gladden the mind, knowing how to develop the joyful states, knowing how to experience that tranquility of body and mind so that everything that comes along in life or in meditation can be held with a very light, open-hearted attitude of contentment. So even if the knee hurts or the something is itching or something is too warm or something is too cold or there's some worry or some thought intruding, the heart has got this just contentment, say, this kindness to experience all of that with love and kindness and warmth. If this first step, it's called Pamoja, P-A-M-O-J-J-A, Pamoja. Moja is related to mudita, which is sympathetic joy or appreciation. And pa means it's extra strong. So this strong appreciation, this strong sympathetic joy We need to learn how to arouse it. Now, this may be different for different individuals. The verses that I read and the suggestions I made at the beginning were in terms of developing the faith or confidence, which is one of the traditional themes that's suggested and practiced all over the Buddhist world to make the mind glad. Some other themes that are used for the same purpose, one is developing the boundless loving kindness and radiating kindness and the Brahmaviharas in all directions. Another practice is based on developing mature virtue and ethics and overcoming any tendencies to be cheating with our own morality, having a clear conscience. That's a pasadi. It's the clear conscience is a very light state, and so that's arising from morality. So when we come to the time of day, if you do a regular evaluation of the day and you remember how the day went and did something happen that was seemed skillful and fortunate, or did something happen that was unskillful, and did we make a mistake or something like that, do you spend too much time ruminating on the things that were difficult, or on the mistaken things, or on the things where you have some remorse, or do you spend a balanced amount of time also remembering the times and the parts of the day in which you have non-remorse? The other day I was I'm taking this course on wise communication, and there was a sort of like an invitation to bring to mind some difficult conversation and reflect about different ways of being skillful to handle that difficult situation. But it so happened that I was on my quiet day when I listened to this lecture, and I didn't have any difficult conversations in my mind. I wasn't actually feeling difficult towards anybody at all in my immediate circle. And I had no desire to, stir up a difficult mindset of having difficult feelings or thoughts about anybody. And so that gave me, this wonderful joy. Say, well, yes, it's okay. There are these moments in which I don't resent anybody, and I don't dislike anybody, and I'm just, everything is just okay. Then the mind is only got this attitude of friendliness. Well, if that was happened for you, you should mark it clearly, put a bright spotlight on it, and mark it as this is a merit for you. And a merit for you is some action of the body, speech, or mind, which is supporting your own happiness and the happiness of others and the happiness of both. And remembering that, you can use that to gladden the mind. Or if you do things that are generous, this is another thing that's in traditional Buddhist culture. People are very generous, both to the monks and to anybody in need. And when they give or when they help, they have this assumption that because of being generous, they will feel happy. And so while they're planning about what they're going to give, they feel very happy. While they're doing the work and preparing the thing that they're going to give, they feel happy. While they're going to the place that they're going to be giving, their gift, they feel happy. And then when they give the gift, they feel happy. And then afterwards, they remember giving the gift and they feel happy. And so that's kind of like how merit works. So don't look down on merit. We can use merit, and we use it to be able to bring up that paumoja, that gladness in the mind, which is a foundation, a launching point for the development of our bhavana, the development of our meditation and our path of wisdom. From that gladness of mind, the next step is called piti, which is usually translated as bliss or something like that. And piti is one of the factors of awakening. So it's a very powerful force. My suggestion is that whether a confidence or faith, whether reflecting on morality, reflecting on generosity, or reflecting on whatever else that you have in your life, which brings up, some very clear reflection or way that you can arouse that gladness. There's one other guided meditation that we discovered that was too long for this class, but if you want to try it, you can go to the Long Discourses of the Buddha and look up number 17, which is called the Mahasudassana Sutta. It's about a king. The Buddha was at his parinibbana between the saltir trees, going to his final death in this body. And his assistant Ananda was saying, "Oh, Venerable, why are you passing away in this little piece of nowhere out in the bush?" And the Buddha said, "Well, it used to be this great, beautiful city with this great king." And it's completely over the top. It's like the king is building a castle and a fountain and planting trees and doing all of these things. And everything is made of gold and silver and crystals and rubies and gems. And but the punchline of the sutta is that it all passes away. All these are conditioned phenomena that passed away. So impermanent, unstable are conditions. And seeing that impermanence is enough to become dispassionate and freed regarding conditions. So we were taking this really over-the-top fantasy. It's like the king is building his castle. And the castle and all of the powers and all of the gifts and all of the gains he has are the result of his previous merits, his good deeds that he's done over many lifetimes. So he's done so many merits. He's been a bodhisattva for many lifetimes. He's this powerful king. But it's all impermanent. He has a beautiful castle, but it's impermanent. He has a beautiful fountain, a beautiful lotus pond, but it's all impermanent. He is beloved by all the people in the kingdom. When they see him, they want him to go slow so they can look at him. And he loves all the people in his kingdom so much, he wants to go slow so he can look at them because he loves them so much. But it's all impermanent. He does many good deeds of giving gifts and helping people to get all the things they want, but it's all impermanent. Then at the end of the sutta, his chief wife comes to him and sees that he's close to passing away. Oh, he's taken up meditation, by the way. In the meantime, he goes on the porch of his Dhamma castle on the beautiful sofa with leopard skin couch and made of ivory, and goes into a deep meditation and broadcasts the four Brahmaviharas in all the directions, and practices deep meditation. And then he renounces, he begins to renounce his wealth and using less and less of it. And then his wife comes and says, dear king, please don't pass away. Think of all your wealth. And because of that, you should live on. Think of how much the people love you. And because of that, you should live on. Think of all the things that you've accomplished. And because of that, you should live on. And he says, no. That's very unpleasant for me to hear that. Actually, what you should be telling me is, don't cling to anything. Let everything go. Let it all pass away. So we think of this sutta as being like visualizing the beauty of mature, virtuous, meritorious actions and the fruits of all of those merits. Like the Tibetan mandala, they make the beautiful pattern out of sand, and then at the end it's swept away. And having brought to mind those things that make the mind glad, and then letting it go and coming into emptiness, actually the gladness remains, and the gladness is even more light and more free and more beautiful because we're not clinging to any of these conditions. And so this, we think, is the most skillful way, and something that can be found in the early text of the suttas. These are several different kinds of meditation to make the mind glad. These are in the realm of merits, which would be leading to happiness in this lifetime and leading to a heavenly rebirth. But if we add into that the remembering to make them impermanent and let them go, then it becomes like the launch pad for the evolution of the deep wisdom and liberation from samsara, to be able to take off. So this is my talk. We've been talking about this at our place for about 6 weeks, and you are the lucky ones because you're at the end of the line, and we've been through these themes several times, and the more we reflect about it, the more clear it comes to us. And so I hope you can see the happiness and clarity that I feel with this particular teaching. And I'm really glad to let you know, because I don't hear this kind of meditation or contemplation taught very much. And I think it's a really good, important practice that we need to have. So with that, there's just 8 minutes. I'll stay as long as you want. If anybody would like to make comments or ask questions, and I'll invite or to take care of if anybody wants to comment.
Thank you. So I guess maybe because of all that's going on in our culture right now. So I'm thinking of this king who has so much because he's done so much good. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. And we could have a king like that too.
Yeah, right. Maybe. Anyway. from your prayers. I can't help, seems so odd to ask this, but so if he has all this beauty, that means that the people in his village or his people in his town had to work really hard to provide all these things for him. And they suffered. Where does, is that in that story anywhere?
Not so much in that story. You know, this is a fable. The thing with the stress and the dukkha and the injustice in the world. Oh, and by the way, I mentioned that he was building a Dhamma palace. That has a double meaning. The palace of Dhamma means the palace of the truth or the Buddha's teaching. And the palace of Dhamma also means the palace of justice. In the secular meaning of Dhamma is justice. So we want the, one of our prayers is that let the king be just. The suffering in the world, comes because we took a human birth and we got these bodies that are subject to old age, sickness, and death, and subject to all kinds of uncertainty and vagaries of, you know, climate and weather and all of the ups and downs of civilizations. Within all of that stress, then each individual who's in that storm, whether they experience extreme suffering or whether they don't experience extreme suffering, actually depends on that individual. There can be individuals who are deeply oppressed by injustice, treated unfairly, and even tortured. But because of their spiritual maturity or something about their conditions, they are able to rise above it and able to go through that experience without being injured by it, without being poisoned by it. And then there are other individuals who are very fortunate, and they live in a palace with four kinds of silver and gold and all of that. And because of their choices and also maybe what they came into this birth with, they're miserable. They're corrupt, they're miserable, they're bad, and they do suffer, and they suffer a lot. So what's high and low in society doesn't necessarily correspond to who's suffering and who's not suffering. But even those who are suffering, you know, that's the whole point of these teachings, is how to find the way to come out of suffering. And having cheered ourselves up and made the mind joyful, my idea is that then one can go out in the world and do the work and be really open-hearted about the difficulties in the world. However, even with our, like, fully experiencing the suffering of the world and the suffering that we have internally, in some way we are not poisoned by that. And we don't get poisoned by it, and we don't get sick by it, because we have some protection. And you know, the protection is this path of practice. Another verse that we chant every day these days is the Ratana Sutta, the Triple Gems. And the backstory of that is there was a plague in the city, and people were dying right and left. They were throwing the corpses outside the wall of the city because they couldn't bury them. And it was just a terrible situation. And so the monks went around the city three times. They marched around the city chanting to make the sickness go back. And so it's good for us to go and march around the city and make the sickness of prejudice and hatred go back, as well as making the germs go back. And so I don't think there's any conflict whatsoever between this visualization of this beauty that is sort of like a material wealth and being having a proper presence and awareness for the dukkha.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So, another question.
You know? I see you.
So, was the king a Buddhist practitioner?
He was. He was the Bodhisattva. He was the Buddha in a previous birth.
So, I'm wondering if the giving up of all his treasures was part of nothing must be clung to.
Exactly.
I, me, or mine.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Thank you. But he took a long time letting go.
Oh, right. Hundreds of years, you know, because it's a fable. They lived for hundreds of years.
He was enjoying all of it for a very, very long time, and then he was ready to let go.
You say something about the impermanence of the gladness.
Yes. It's also conditioned. Even, you know, the king, one of the things that's impermanent is the king practiced meditation. He practiced the Brahma Viharas and he obtained the jhanas. He obtained these high meditation states, and meditation is impermanent. It's conditioned. It's, you know, it's conditioned by, we learned about it, we came and we sat on the cushion, we followed certain procedures and we exercised a discipline, and then because of these conditions, the mind was able to obtain these really beautiful, profound states, different even than anything we could have in ordinary life. And not to mention the gladness is sort of like a preliminary gladness. So that preliminary gladness up to the most profound thing you can experience in meditation, it's conditioned and it's impermanent. And if, like within your meditation, you see that, then standing on that realization of the impermanence of those states, you turn away from the most profound and beautiful thing you could ever experience and turn towards Nibbana.
Is it a matter of intending to do it or remembering to do it?
When we read the suttas and we have these ideas, you know, that that phrase of, you know, coming up to a jhana or to a profound meditation state, seeing it conditioned, seeing that it's unsatisfactory because it's conditioned and impermanent, and then based on that, turn towards Nibbana. So then, like those who've read the sutta, they may have that thought planted in their mind, but they haven't like realized it. But then within a deep state of practice, when the conditions are right, then the thought that has been planted before could more easily come along and could help us to know what to do with, when we're within those deep states. It's a touchy thing. You don't want to just, you're not trying to force yourself to march along according to a program, because it's really coming up naturally. But it's because you've planted some ideas also that can make them come along.
So lightness is impermanent, but I assume it has no object. And yet for me, experiencing gladness without something to be glad about is very challenging. But is it true then that gladness has no object? It just comes kind of out of nowhere?
To my understanding, gladness is part of conditioned reality. It depends on conditions. It arises because of conditions. And then when the conditions change, then it could cease. So gladness could arise like spontaneously and you don't even really know where it comes from. And then it can arise because you have intentionally turned your mind towards a particular theme which is supportive of gladness. It could happen either way. If it's not easy for you to find gladness, some people have that mind, they're just like Eeyore types or something, and they don't find gladness very easily. And so then really being mindful and observing yourself and noticing when gladness arises, and when it arises, kind of take a look and say, okay, so what's happening right now? What are the conditions happening right now that support this? One of the right efforts is to be able to arouse a wholesome state of mind that did not exist before. And this can be done intentionally. Later, you're not, we can practice like a pure mindfulness in which we're not directing and controlling and pushing and prodding the mind to go in a particular channel. But then at other times, we are able to make the mind go in a particular channel. So both things are actually part of our practice, and they're legitimate to do if you know the right time.
Thank you.
Yes?
I don't know, this is kind of an important question, but I remember a talk you gave at Spirit Rock at least 10 years ago, and it appeared to me that you needed to work at bringing bright gladness into your practice. Am I incorrect, or have you had to do that?
My personal path was very much coming out of a lot of dukkha because of some traumas that I had in my life.
Yes, that's what I thought.
And so I don't think it was a waste, but I spent quite a number of years, really, like analyzing all the factors of dukkha and how it comes along and how it gets sort of like self-perpetuating, and then how to kind of get out of it. And I know that there are times when even somebody who suffers a lot, they forget to be sad and find the mind is bright. But that's not enough. It's better to be able to find out how to live there. After spending so many years working on finding ways to extricate myself from dukkha, I got the idea about developing the perception of the three marks of impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And then after that was more well developed, a lot of the things that used to trigger my unwholesome reactions, it's like there was no ammo in the gun, and so that it just the triggering didn't happen in the first place. So I wasn't always pulling myself out of a pit, just the mind was more level and smooth, and you know, gradually gets like more and more mellow.
I like the practice of bringing in bright karma, because I tend to go in the other direction. But I think the practice of establishing, we're reading Ajahn Suchito's book on karma, where he really talks about bringing in bright mind and gladness. And I think that that's a very good practice.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. Thank you.